Please turn with me to Philippians 4, 10 through 13. In your pew Bibles, that is page 982. Philippians 4, 10 to 13. I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning, folks. It's great to be up here behind this pulpit again, although I did enjoy the brief break from preaching last week. It was such a joy for me to have my dad here. Like I said, not just so I could have a break, but more importantly, so I could sit under his teaching and ministry again. I hope it was a blessing to you as it was to me. Now, my dad, when he was behind this pulpit, he didn't waste an opportunity to dog on me. And I told him afterwards that I could have the last word, you know, since this is my pulpit. But I'm going to take the high road, and I'm not going to retaliate. I'm going to be a respectful son. Well, we are back in Philippians, and we are approaching the end of our exposition of this great letter of Paul to the Philippians. That the end is quickly coming. You can see the white space there, I'm sure, on the bottom of your Bibles, which tells us that the end is in sight. I think after this sermon, we'll have just two more in the book of Philippians. And of course, we're looking forward in a couple weeks to having our friend Drew Corbett here sharing with us from God's Word. But today we are in chapter 4, and we're going to be looking at verses 10 to 13, the passage that Ben just read for us. And as we look to our Bibles this morning, I think we'll see that there's a new section that started. Now, these section headings are not inspired by any means, but I think the editors have rightly recognized that when you come to verse 10, you really come up on a new section. Paul's train of thought is changing slightly, and he begins to deal with a different subject matter. In this section that we're engaging in this morning, Paul is wrapping up his letter to the Philippians. He's really drawing things to a close, and he's doing so by mentioning the fact that they had given a gift to him. Now, this is something that he had indicated previous. We saw this in the earlier parts of chapter 1. But what he's doing here is he's actually recognizing their gift in a formal section of the letter. It's a little bit weird that he would wait until the very end to recognize the fact that they had given him a very generous financial gift of support. It's a little weird because you'd expect that to come right off the bat, right from the get-go. In fact, it seems as if this gift that they've given to him was the occasion for his letter. In other words, it was the very reason why he put pen to paper to write this letter. Excuse me. So it is a little bit weird that it's coming explicitly at the end, but I will remind you that we did look at this in the early parts of chapter 1. Paul mentions the fact... I'm very sorry. I'm a little out of practice, I guess. Paul mentions the fact that they had remembered him with a gift, although he does it kind of subtly. This is back in chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, where he says, I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy, because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Now, that is a very veiled reference to the fact that they had given him a gift. And the only way that we know is from his word choice there, partnership. And you might remember back that when we discussed this, that their partnership or their fellowship in the gospel with him was very specifically shown and demonstrated by the fact that they had financially supported him in his work. So when at the very beginning of the letter, he draws attention to their partnership and the fact that he thanks the Lord for it and is joyful about it, he certainly has in mind their financial gift. But he doesn't really get to it explicitly until this later section, this section that we're at today. Paul is bringing up explicitly this matter of their gift, and he's doing it in a formal section of the letter. And we've looked at this before, all the way through Philippians. This is a letter that he has written to a church, a group of people. And as such, it has all of the elements that any kind of a letter in that day and age would have. We've looked at the greeting, the salutation, the prayer on behalf of the recipient. And now we come to a section that is very common in letters where the recipient is acknowledging, is basically saying that he is in receipt of the gift that the people that he's writing to had sent. And so this is a formal section of any kind of a letter. But again, as we've seen, he doesn't just put in these elements of the letter because he's forced to out of convention. And when he does do so, he has something much greater in mind. In fact, what he wants the people to learn is much deeper than the fact that he's thankful and joyful for the gift that they send, although he is certainly that. But he uses these sections of the letter. He uses this section to impart deep theological and very practical truths about Christian living. And he's not going to waste that opportunity again today. What he really wants the Philippians to know, he does want them to know that he's thankful for their gift, but what he really wants them to know is to understand what it means to be content. He's using their gift, the occasion of their gift, as a springboard for a much greater and deeper discussion, a discussion of true Christian contentment. He wants the Philippians to know the secret to Christian contentment, the secret that he has learned. Now, reading between the lines, it would seem that the Philippians did have a problem along these lines. We've kind of tried to identify all throughout the problems that Paul may have been addressing that were specific to the Philippians. We've seen that they lacked joy, and it was likely due to the fact that they were also there was a lot of infighting and quarreling among them. They were considering themselves more than considering other people. They were looking to their own interests. They were arguing and quarreling. They were worrying. All of these things are related to another problem which Paul is getting to right now, and that is the problem of a lack of contentment. And so Paul wants in these final sentences, in these final paragraphs of this letter, he wants these Philippians to understand the secret of Christian contentment. And it's good for us to know too, isn't it? Because if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admit that we also have a problem with being content in our Christian life. We feel the pressure to keep up with the Joneses just as much as the Joneses and whoever else lives next to us. We feel that intense pressure all the time. We tend to complain just as much as the next guy about how little we make compared to what we believe that we're worth. You know, we're not immune as Christians from things like car envy and house envy, which plagues every human being, it seems. And we too often entertain the fantasy that if someone was to write us a check for 10 grand, that would just make everything totally fine in our life. That at that point, we could be content. But until then, we're not quite content. And so we need to also hear from the Apostle Paul through these verses the secret to Christian contentment. And Paul's going to demonstrate for us three things. He's going to teach us three things in the passage before us about Christian contentment. I'm sure there's other things in these verses, but I'm just going to highlight three of them and spend our time on those. And those three things are this. First of all, Christian contentment does not depend on circumstances. Secondly, he wants us to know that Christian contentment is learned. And then third and finally, Christian contentment depends on Christ. So again, if you're making use of the space at the bottom or in the back of the bulletin, these would be the three points that you could jot down. That Christian contentment does not depend on circumstances. Christian contentment is learned. And Christian contentment depends on Christ. So let's turn our attention to the first of these lessons, and that is that Christian contentment does not depend on circumstances. But let's first try to get a little bit of a better understanding of the context of what's going on here in this passage. In verse 10, Paul rejoices in the Lord greatly because the Philippians had, he says, revived their concern for him. Now, their concern for him, or literally their thinking of him, their thoughts for his concern, for his needs, took the form of a financial gift. And it was probably a large amount, a pretty significant gift that they had given the Apostle Paul. So that was how they manifested their concern or their thoughts towards him. And Paul is very, very thankful for this. He frames his thankfulness in terms of his joy in the Lord. You notice that he doesn't come right out and say, "I'm thankful, thank you very much." He puts it like this: "I rejoiced in the Lord that you had done this, that you had demonstrated your concern for me this way." Now, Paul hastens to add that they had always been concerned for him. That was never really the issue. But what the issue was, it seemed, that they lacked the opportunity to help him or to enter into partnership with him. It's really impossible for us to know why it was that the Philippians were prevented from showing their support or from supporting Paul in the past. There's so many different options of what it could be. It could be something on Paul's end. Perhaps because of his many court appearances and all the legal proceedings, it's very possible that it was hard to pin him down in a particular location long enough to get money sent to him. Or it could be Paul may have suggested that they not give, because you may know that during Paul's ministry, he came under fire a lot from lots of different opponents who thought, "Oh, Paul's just in this gospel thing. He's just in the ministry here for money. You know, he's fleecing all these churches for money, and he's making a good buck at it. Yeah, of course he's in the ministry." Well, Paul sometimes wanted to just totally stifle that accusation and not receive anything from churches at all. In fact, he prided himself in the fact that he worked when he was among certain churches, and that he provided for his own needs. And he was doing that to stifle these accusations. So something like that could have been going on in Paul's life. It could have been something on the Philippians' end. Perhaps they were just financially unable to give him the type of support that they knew that he needed. Or perhaps they didn't have the messenger that they needed to get their gift to Paul. You know that the gift that they sent on this occasion came through the messenger of Epaphroditus. That was the messenger that they had sent, and along with Epaphroditus, they sent this financial gift. And so maybe for a time they had lacked someone that was able or willing to travel with a big sum of money through dangerous roads. Bottom line is, we don't know why. All we do know is that they were prevented and they had no occasion to be concerned for him or to demonstrate their concern for him. We do know that it must have been something beyond their control, because Paul in no way in these verses scolds the Philippians, saying that there's something deficient in them, that they didn't support him. No, he's full of praise for them. So it was something that was totally beyond their control. We also know that the church had given quite generously in the past. And we get this from verses 14 and 15. And again, that's from a passage that we'll look at next week. But 14 and 15 say this: "Yet it was kind of you to share my trouble. And you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving, except you only. Even in Thessalonica, you sent help for my needs once and again. No, the Philippians had been very generous to Paul in the past. Even right from the first day of their founding, Paul is referencing when he left Macedonia. Well, he was in Macedonia in the first place to start their church. He was the founder of their church, as we saw in Acts chapter 16. And he says here that right from that point and onward, these Philippians, exclusively almost, other churches weren't involved. The Philippian believers were involved quite regularly in giving and receiving, looking after Paul's needs, showing concern for him. Paul uses the word revived, and this is a really, really interesting word. It's a word that's only used here in the New Testament, and it's a word that Paul gets from the field of horticulture. And it's the word that's used for a tree that has, after laying dormant for a whole winter, in springtime just kind of bursts forth with buds and blossoms. And so he's saying that their generosity was much like this. For whatever reason, they were prevented from giving in the past, and so they had gone through a winter, but now their concern had been revived. It was the springtime of their concern, and it was just kind of bursting forth in vibrant color. And it's a beautiful and vivid language that Paul uses to describe their gift. And then in verse 11, Paul wants to add a clarification. And again, this is introduced by those words, "not that." And I know that we discussed this before when we came across it in chapter 3, verse 12. And we're actually going to come across it again next week in verse 17. And whenever Paul says "not that," he's really just quickly wanting to add a clarification. It's not that he's saying this. And so there's one thing that he really wants to clarify. And it's this. Paul wants to clarify that he is not talking about being in need. He doesn't want this thank you note of his, or this thank you section, to come across as an appeal for more money and more support. And any of you that support missionaries or maybe have given to a school or some other institution, Christian institution, in the past, you may have experienced that sometimes those thank you letters that you get, they come across as just a thinly veiled excuse or disguise for more money. You know, the letter comes to you thanking you, but really, it's asking you for more money. And Paul's wanting to clarify that is not what he's doing. Furthermore, he doesn't want them to think that his joy is based on the fact that they have sent this money to him. He doesn't want them to think that, okay, now that he has money and resources to be able to meet his needs and do what he needs to do, that, okay, everything is fine and he's joyful and he's content now. He wants them to understand that his joy is not conditioned on the fact that they had given him this gift. He is not speaking of being in need. And it's really at this point that Paul begins to launch into this discussion about Christian contentment, because it follows very naturally from what he's been talking about. And according to Paul, Christian contentment does not depend on circumstances. This is the first thing that we want to see from this verse. And the summary statement for this can be found in verse 12, where Paul says that he has learned, in whatever situation I am, to be content. So if you put that a different way, what Paul is really saying is that he is content no matter what situation he happens to be in at any particular point in time. Do you remember back in the day when we discussed joy and the like? We made a distinction between joy and happiness. We said that happiness was a superficial kind of a state of mind, and it was entirely dependent on what was happening to you. It was entirely dependent on your given circumstances. So when things are going well, you're happy. When things are going poorly, you're sad. Well, we wanted to make a distinction between that and joy, which we said ran much deeper than circumstances. Joy, we said, was a deep-seated state of the soul that was just at peace and trusting in God, no matter what kind of circumstances assailed you at any given time. Well, a very related concept to joy is this concept of contentment, which is the focus of Paul's discussion here. And both of them, they're related in many ways, but fundamental to their relationship is the fact that both of them, both joy and contentment, do not depend on circumstance. What is happening in your life really have no bearing on your joy and your contentment if you do indeed have it. Paul goes on, he goes to great lengths, really, to explain this in verse 12, and he does so by repeating over and over the different extremes that he has been through and that a person could go through in their life. And I'll draw your attention to this. This is in verse 12, where he says, "I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." Do you see, he's citing all of the vast extremes of situations that you can face. And he's saying, you know, I've been here and I've been here. And, you know, when you follow that along, it ends up looking like a roller coaster ride of circumstance. And that is exactly what Paul has experienced. He's experienced the lowest of the low, and he's experienced the highest of the high, and every conceivable circumstance in the middle. Now, while his circumstances have been something of a roller coaster ride, he wants us to understand that his contentment hasn't followed that same pattern. His contentment stays as a constant, even though his circumstances are swirling about and, like I said, riding that roller coaster. his contentment, he says, in the middle of verse 12, functions in any and every circumstance. Any possible circumstance that you could throw at him, Paul is saying that he is or would be content. If you've ever hiked Watkins Glen, I got the chance to do this a month or two ago. You may have noticed that there is a wide variety of flora and fauna all the way through the gorge, through the glen there. And this is because different plants and animal species have very specific requirements in terms of what they need to grow and thrive and all the rest. And so if you're hiking through the deep part of the gorge, you'll notice that down lower, you'll find a lot of plants that that can tolerate a lot of water because of the splashing from the various waterfalls. And also because of the angle of how the sun comes in, those areas down there tend to be very dark. And so you're going to find plants that thrive in cool and wet climates and don't require a lot of sunlight. And on the other extreme, on the top end, you're going to see plants that can do well without very much water, because any water that comes just migrates down through the rock. And they're faced a lot of times with direct sunlight. And so you get totally different plants that grow in those two different climates. And I fear that this is how many of us are. I fear that we are very specific plants that require a very specific set of circumstances if we're going to grow or thrive. We require a certain income level. We require, you can just run down through the list. If you don't have this, 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 and this, then we're not going to grow, or so we think, or we're not going to be content. I feel that when our conditions are in flux, so when we're going from the lows to the highs, I feel like we are not only following that roller coaster ride in terms of our experiences, but our contentment often feels like it's strapped into that car right beside us with that bar, pressing in on it. And it's riding that roller coaster right along with us. But that is totally, I hope you can see, that is totally opposite to what Paul would have. And I just wonder, have you charted this out in your own life in terms of your own Christian contentment? Does your contentment fluctuate with your circumstances? Does your contentment, say, rise and fall with in direct proportion with your bank account balance? Can you say that you're content in feast or famine, in rags or riches? Can you say that you are just as content when you have a fully funded 401k as when you're faced with foreclosure? Well, this is these are deadly serious issues, and Paul would have us to be content no matter what the circumstances. He wants our contentment to be maintained despite the circumstances of our lives. Can you say with Paul that you have learned in any and every circumstances to be content? Well, let's move on to the second thing that Paul wants to teach us, and that is that Christian contentment is learned. So you might think, well, it's kind of unfair to compare ourselves with Paul. After all, he's the super apostle, and he had it all together, right? Well, I think we've dismissed this objection many times before in our study of Philippians. But I want you to see again from this passage that Paul is not saying that at all. We saw this already back in chapter 3, where he says, I've not obtained all this, I'm not already perfect, but I press on to make it my own. But in this particular passage, Paul wants us to know the very important point that could easily be missed if we're just skipping over it. But he wants us to know and understand that he has learned the secret to Christian contentment. You see this in verse 11, don't you? He says, I have learned. He says this over and over, in fact. In verse 11, he says, I have learned. In verse 12, he says, I know. And then he says it again in verse 12, I know. And when he says, I know, that's really just a synonym for I have learned. These are things that he now knows. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. And then he says again at the end of verse 12, I have learned the secret of facing plenty, etc. So he says this over and over again. He wants us to understand that this is something that he's learned. He has been taught this because of bitter and difficult circumstances, and even in the midst of good circumstances, he's learned this. You know that Paul has faced both of these situations, abounding and being in need. As a young theologian, or a Pharisee, really, it was very easy to imagine that he was a wealthy young man, young ruler, and it seems that Paul had a trade that he was good at. And so it's very easy to imagine that Paul had a lot of money at one point in his life. But we also know that he went to the other extreme. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 11, Paul could testify to this. He says, to this present hour we hunger and thirst. We are poorly dressed and buffeted and homeless. And we labor, working with our own hands. Now, to recognize that Christian contentment is a learned behavior is not to give us any kind of excuse for persisting in our fickleness in terms of our own contentment. It's not to give us an excuse for just continuing along that roller coaster of contentment that we've been on for so long. It's simply to give us encouragement that this is part of what God is working in us. It's part of what God is willing and working in us to his good purpose. It's part of that work that he has started in us that he is going to bring to completion. These are things that we are learning if we are being faithful Christians and if we are being sanctified. And so we don't have to get totally discouraged and totally down in the dumps in a way that would paralyze us by recognizing that we're not there yet. No, this is something that Christians need to learn. This is something that Paul himself learned. And so I wonder, can you or can I, can we look back on our lives and see progress in terms of our Christian contentment? Perhaps you can think back to the time when you were first married. You know, you and your spouse were dinks, they call it. Dual income, no kids. And you were both making money. You had no really no real responsibilities in terms of kids, and so you're making all this money. But maybe you can remember that at that point in your life, you were not content. And you thought of all your income potential, and you thought of all the things that you wanted to do, be able to do, and have. And maybe you think, look back on that time, and you realize you weren't content. But maybe you look at yourself now, and you're sisks, we could call it, single income, six kids. And you think, you know, there's a very real sense in which I'm living paycheck to paycheck. You know, I've got all of these responsibilities, all of these good things, a house payment, kids, all the rest. But you know what? There's a sense that I'm very content with that. And if you can look back on that scenario or any other kind of scenario that is true of your life, then you should be able to see progress there. You should be able to see the way that the Lord has been faithful to lead you and cause you to grow along these lines. And so praise the Lord if you are learning to be content. So this is the first week of school for all of our kids, and that's an exciting time. But there's the tendency that we have to just think that, okay, kids are going off to school because they need to learn stuff. Well, I hope this verse can tell us that in the Christian life, school is always in session. You don't get a summer break from learning when you're in the Christian life. You are always, and God desires that we would constantly be maturing and developing and growing and becoming more and more like Christ. He wants us to develop in terms of our own personal sanctification. And he designs all kinds of events. Everything that providentially comes into our lives are designed so that we would grow and so that we would mature and develop. My dad spoke last week on God's purposes in our problems, and it was a very helpful sermon for me at least. But one thing that you can know when you have problems in your life, one of God's purposes that you can always count on is the fact that he wants you to learn. He wants you to learn and develop and grow and get further along in your Christian life. And he wants us to do this specifically today in terms of our Christian contentment. Now, perhaps he's providentially ordering something in your life right now. He's bringing a circumstance to bear on your life that is primarily designed to teach you this, to teach you to be content no matter what the circumstances. If you're currently going through such a difficulty, let me give you the type of counsel that I know John Piper would give you if he was here today. He would say something like, don't waste your financial crisis. You know, he likes using that language, don't waste such and such. And so if you have a financial crisis right now, don't waste it. Don't waste it by being bitter and grumbling against God and against your circumstances. Use it as a perfect opportunity to learn contentment no matter what the circumstances. View it as a God-ordained opportunity to learn contentment. Well, that's all I'll say about that point. I want to move on finally to the third and final point, and that is that Christian contentment depends on Christ. We've seen what it's independent of. Christian contentment does not depend on circumstances, but it is, at the end of the day, dependent. It does depend on something, and that is, it depends on Christ. Now, when Paul says that he's learned to be content, again, I want to draw your attention to that word that he uses for content. And it also is a very interesting and specific word. This is a word that was well known in philosophy in their day, especially in Stoic philosophy. We saw a couple weeks ago that Paul didn't shy away from using language and terminology that was common to the philosophers of his day. We saw this at the end of chapter, or I'm sorry, in the middle of chapter 4 there, verses 8 and following. He uses words like true and honorable and pure and lovely, commendable, excellent. All of these things we saw were very standard, kind of stock phrases in ethical philosophy. And so secular philosophers would put up all of these as ideals of things to strive for in your ethical pursuit. But Paul's not afraid to use those because he understands them much more deeper than any secular philosopher could. He understands what they mean and where they're rooted, rooted as they are in the very nature of God himself. And so he can use them but put the distinctively Christian spin on them or really uncover the distinctively Christian essence of all of these things. But he does this again today when he in the passage before us today when he uses the word content. He says that he's learned to be content, and that word content was one of the highest of the Stoic ideals. So those who were into Stoic philosophy put forth contentment as their very highest goal and attainment for life. Well, you might be wondering, what is Stoic philosophy? And I would bet that you probably know something about Stoic philosophy just based on the fact that that word is retained in our language. You know, we say that someone is Stoic, which means that they're kind of unfeeling and unflinching in the midst of really deep turmoil. They have a stiff upper lip. They just, nothing really affects them. They're Stoic. Well, this essentially was Stoic philosophy. Stoics believe that a person ought to be able to independently kind of harness his own personal resources in order to deal with any storm, any affliction that would come his way. The Stoic doctrine was this, and I'm quoting here, "Man should be sufficient unto himself for all things, and able, by the power of his own will, to resist the force of circumstance." So the word that Paul uses for content carries with it, in Stoic thought, the idea or the connotations of independence and, like I said, harnessing your own inner resources in order to be able to withstand anything. It really has the idea of self-reliance and independence. Well, Stoic philosophy as a whole system is pretty much dead today. But I think you can understand just from the brief description that we've given here that its main tenets are alive and well in our day and age. Take, for example, the poem Invictus. I don't know, maybe some of you have heard this poem before. It was written by a man named William Ernest Henley. And it was written by him when he was lying in the hospital bed after his leg had just been amputated below the knee, because he had developed tuberculosis of the bone. So Henley, as a young man, writes this poem, Invictus, and I'll read it for you, and see if you can catch the spirit of Stoicism. He writes this, "Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how strait the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Well, against the ignorant and the arrogant ideals of Stoic philosophy, Paul is going to radically redefine the concept of contentment by using their very same word. For Paul, Christian contentment is not independence, but it is fundamentally dependence on Christ. We see this probably better than anywhere in Paul's personal doctrine, which we find in verse 13. He says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Have you heard that verse before? I suspect that you have, because probably right up there with John 3:16 is probably the most quoted verse in all of Scripture. And actually, like John 3:16, you've probably seen it a lot at football games in various locations. And I also would hazard the guess that most of the time that you've seen this, it's probably been taken way out of context. And maybe you can see something of the context from our discussion so far. One of the most exciting college football players to watch over the last couple of years has been Tim Tebow. He's in the big leagues now, but he played for his college career with the Florida Gators. And one thing that's amazing about Tebow is not so much his skill, although that is amazing. But what's amazing about Tim Tebow is the fact that he has deep Christian convictions and he has a very strong Christian character that just exudes everywhere that he is. And for that, we ought to be thankful. But one thing that he would do is he would paint in scripture verses into the eye black, you know, that black stuff that football players put under their eyes. And oftentimes he had this verse in his painted into his eye black. Philippians 4:13, which is fine, of course. I don't mean to dog Tebow, but I hope you can see that when Paul says I can do all things, he doesn't primarily have in mind, you know, the ability to rush for 160 yards or rush for five touchdowns. Paul doesn't really have that kind of stuff in mind. But unfortunately, this verse's popularity is due in large part to the fact that we take it to mean that with God's help, we can accomplish any feat, and often it's a very extraordinary feat that any human could ever hope to do. And so, you know, you go to a Christian bookstore and you'll see a really nice poster in a nice frame, and it'll have this verse on it, and it'll have a picture of a cat that's getting ready to leap from a couch to a kitchen table that's 20 feet away. I guess the cat is saying, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's the kind of stuff that you'll see this verse associated with, unfortunately. But I hope that you can see that is not the proper application of this verse. And unfortunately, that kind of application of this verse tends to take the focus where it's meant to be, that is on Christ, and put it on the I part of it. You know, it says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. The emphasis of that verse is supposed to be on the him who strengthens me, but we take this verse to mean, you know, I can do a lot of crazy things with the Lord giving me strength. And so it's known as the boxing verse. You know, people will write it onto their boxing gloves. But the problem is, if you get two Christian boxers that are both relying on the promise of that verse, then you've got a real problem. I read a sermon recently from Norman Vincent Peale, and that name might ring a bell to you. And it's probably due to the fact that he was one of the most famous Protestant ministers of the last century. And he was known, in my opinion, for all the wrong reasons. He was known probably best by his best-selling book, The Power of Positive Thinking. And he was a preacher, I believe in New York City. And he preached on this verse, Philippians 4:13, and the title of the sermon was right along, you can almost predict what it is based on his mindset, but the title of the sermon was, Believe You Can, and You Can. And the kind of the climax to his sermon is this. Take a long look at yourself. Take a long, hard look at your situation. Take a good, thrilling look at what you want to do and what you want to be. And do it. Be it. Take charge of your mind. Enormous power is there. Don't ever think yourself as weak, little, unfortunate, pushed around, victim of this or that. Don't be the victim of anything. Take charge of your mind in the name of Christ. Believe that you can, and you can. Well, I think you can see, based on all of the confusion that swirls about on this particular text, Philippians 4:13, that we need to examine the context. And we've done so already this morning. But it helps us to understand that when Paul says all things, you know, he's not talking about whatever, name your extraordinary human feat. He's not talking about that. When he says all things, what he's talking about is being able to weather any kind of circumstance that the Lord providentially brings into his life. He knows how to abound. He knows how to be in need. And he can do all things through Christ who strengthens him. That is what Paul is talking about. And again, it is putting... He's not talking about breaking the 3-minute and 43-second mile. He's talking about the fact that Christ strengthens him to be able to face every single one of these circumstances and have a real deep Christian contentment that doesn't fluctuate along with the circumstances. Those are the all things that Paul can do, again, through the one that gives him strength. And he doesn't, in contrast to the Stoics, he doesn't do this by the force of his own inner resources. He doesn't do this because he's independent. He doesn't do this on his own. He does this only, the only reason that Paul can say that he has learned to be content is because of who he's depending on. He's depending on the one that can supply strength to you. He's doing it based and totally dependent on the one who can comfort you and encourage you and give you all of the resources, all of the external divine resources for going through a difficult circumstances or even a good circumstances. He does all these things through him who strengthens him. He's totally dependent. The hero of this verse is the Lord, because he is the supplier of the strength. He's the one that's giving physical not physical strength, but he's giving, like I said, he's giving that real spiritual strength. He's giving all of the resources that we have for dealing with difficult circumstances. He gives us everything that we need for life and godliness. He gives us everything that we need for our own Christian contentment, even though the storms might be brutal, even though we might face all sorts of very, very difficult situations. I think the hymn writer put it really well when he wrote, "Strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow." That is what we have in Christ. That is what we have through the God who gives us all of these resources. Paul wants us desperately to understand the thing that he has himself come to learn, that Christ, that we are dependent on Christ if we are to have Christian contentment. This isn't something that we can do on our own. And so in closing, I would ask us, how are we doing with our contentment? Is it something, if we're really honest with ourselves, is kind of comes and goes or fluctuates? And if we really seek to put our finger on it, if we really kind of chart it out, we can see that our contentment is fluctuating in the same frequency as our outward circumstances. I wonder, are you learning contentment? If you look back on your life, on your situations, can you see a noticeable development in terms of your contentment, even though you have difficult or trying circumstances? Are you, for your Christian contentment, are you totally reliant on Christ? Or are you kind of stoic about the whole thing? If you have a difficult situation that comes and faces you, do you just kind of unflinchingly and unfeelingly, with a stiff upper lip, just say, "Yeah, come on, hit me"? And are you trying in the first place to summon up everything that you have internally to weather that? Well, I would want you to understand that that is not the Christian way. That's the way of the Stoic philosophers that are all dead and gone. That is not what Christ would have us do. Christ wants us to depend on him and fully rely on him for the strength that we need. Well, it seems to me that one really good gauge of our contentment is our generosity. That is, if we are truly content, then it's going to manifest itself in our generosity towards people who are also going through very difficult situations. And so it's a really wonderful opportunity for us now to take up our benevolence offering. You know that we had we missed the opportunity because of Balloon Fest last week, but we don't want to just forget about it. So we're going to pray here. The ushers are going to come forward, and we're going to give for the use of those who really need this money. There's many, many needs in our own congregation and our community. And so let us show our contentment by our generosity. Would you join me in prayer?